Good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for joining the conference. This is Samantha Platt from Bank of America, and it's my pleasure to introduce Mike McCabe. Mike is a partner and the head of strategy at StepStone. He's also a member of the board of directors. Mike joined StepStone in 2010 and has been in the industry since 2005. StepStone is a global private markets investment firm with over $600 billion of AUA and $134 billion of AUM, focused on providing customized investment and advisory solutions to clients. Mike, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much, Sam. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. So let's start with an overview of the company. StepStone has been growing incredibly quickly over the years. Can you take a few minutes to provide context for what you do as a solutions provider and how these solutions are valuable across different market backdrops?
Sure. Well, thanks, Sam. Why don't I start answering the question maybe by zooming out a little bit and start with, you know, what our clients are looking for. And I think it's for the most part best described as your clients are thinking about their portfolio construction first from a strategic asset allocation perspective. And they ask themselves, okay, how much of my portfolio can I afford to be illiquid? Why? Because that's where the excess returns historically have come from. And there's persistence with that alpha embedded and the liquidity discount of being illiquid. So the question, you know, investors are asking themselves, how much of this illiquid security can I own? I'm going to max that out. And in the institutional world, what we're seeing is allocations to the private markets have been roughly growing and are now anywhere between 20 to 30%. Of their portfolios in illiquid markets, the private markets, across private equity, venture capital, real estate, infrastructure, and credit. StepStone's role is to help those clients achieve and maintain those portfolio targets across the asset classes and across the strategies in a diversified way, and we'll talk about managed accounts later, and in a customized way. And we do it in a very geographically diversified way. So let's break that down a little bit more. So if we think about an investor who's thinking, okay, I can reach a 30% allocation to illiquids, how am I going to do that? What percentage should I allocate to PE, VC, venture, to real estate, infra, and credit? We will help them design what the underlying allocations are across the illiquid security. And we've purpose-built the business here at StepStone to have large, dedicated investment teams in venture capital, in private equity, in real estate, in infrastructure, and in private credit. Going to the next layer down, well, which strategies should clients pursue within each asset class? Fund investments, if it's a fund investment, which manager should I pick? The complexity of thousands of PPMs showing up every day and every year makes it a challenge for the average investor to figure out which fund to pick. Or a secondary strategy, and we'll talk about secondaries in a bit. Or co-investment strategies, and we'll talk about that as well. So you have the asset classes, and then you have the strategies. And then the last layer down is, geographically speaking, where are investors typically in their process of reaching their target allocations? The U.S. is a fairly mature market. We're seeing allocations roughly at or close to wherever their targets are, and they might be growing a little bit. Outside of the U.S., what we're seeing is the strategic asset allocation models in Europe, the Middle East, Far East, and in Latin America are starting to catch up to the Western models. And so they're starting to adopt a 20 to 30% allocation to the illiquid markets, and they're at 1, 2, 3, or 5%. Who are they going to get to help access the private markets to get them to their targets? Well, the answer is StepStone. And so we've specifically and purposely built our platform with a footprint that is largely outside of the U.S. And so 70% of our management and advisory fees are coming from outside of the U.S. where they're underallocated. And nearly 75 or 80% of our growth, to your question, has come from the geographies. So that's sort of the comprehensive answer to your question.
And you touched on being diversified across, you know, geography, asset class, and strategies. How does this help you during, you know, periods of market distress?
Yeah, it we're purpose-built for an all-weather cycle situation. I'll talk for a little bit about, you know, in a cycle situation. I'll first begin by saying, all right, well, within which asset class might there be more interest? And so we'll think about that through the lens of strategies. So from a primary strategy standpoint, investors might say, huh, interest rates are going up. What asset class or what kind of fund will help me navigate a higher interest rate environment? Well, infrastructure and real estate are natural hedges against higher interest rates. So the inbound calls we're getting from interest on those two asset classes from a primary standpoint are increasing. The same thing in venture capital. Great companies are built in every cycle, and venture capital has always been and has stood the test of time that way for investors to get access to great companies in good times and bad times. So from a primary standpoint, we're seeing a lot of demand for infrastructure, real estate, and believe it or not, venture capital. And lastly, given what's going on with interest rates, our investors are focusing in on strategies that are floating rate. So how do we take advantage of this increase in interest rates? So from a private credit standpoint, StepStone's private credit platform focuses in on floating rate securities that are the most senior in the capital structure, mitigating the risk the most. Now pivoting to, from a strategy standpoint, secondaries become this really interesting countercyclical way to access the private markets at an attractive entry price. And so they're coming in at a discount, and typically the discounts widen during periods of dislocation or stress. And so there's a really interesting demand that we're seeing. And we'll talk about secondaries more, ticking up within the secondary space. So what we've done is we've created a secondary platform for venture capital. We're currently investing out of a $2.6 billion secondary fund dedicated to the venture capital community. It's the largest ever in the history of the asset class. We're currently in market with our flagship private equity secondaries fund. So we have a secondary fund for private equity. We have launched our real estate secondaries fund, which is looking at recapitalizing GP's assets and liquidating LPs out of their securities. And we do secondary investments for infrastructure through managed accounts, and we do secondary investments through managed accounts for private credit. So we've applied the secondaries capabilities that we have across all the asset classes.
Great. So maybe let's continue on with secondaries for a few minutes. You've been one of the largest players, and it's one of the fastest growing segments of the market with some of the highest barriers to entry. Can you maybe take a step back, discuss the differences in the GP versus the LP-led secondaries and where you're seeing the most demand today?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So thank you for going to the bigger question. So I'll take a step back and zoom out. The secondaries business is a derivative of the primary business. And so the way to think about the secondary TAM is by starting with the primary TAM. Trillions and trillions of dollars post-GFC have poured into the private markets from a primary fundraising standpoint. Some percentage of that capital will turn over in the secondary market. So let's start there. There's currently $10 trillion of net asset value in the private markets, sitting there waiting for either an exit by the general partner and or the secondary market to buy and purchase. Of that $10 billion, $7 billion is private equity. The other $3 billion are the other asset classes. If we look at the volume of secondary transactions in 2022, I think the number was something like $108 billion. And then if we go to the next layer down, Sam, and unpack what comprised of that $108 billion, roughly $50 billion came from GP-led transactions. The other $58 billion came from LPs selling their interests. Why is that significant? Well, let's dial the clock back to 2016. The transaction volume in 2016 was roughly $37 billion. Let's just call it a third of where it was in 2022. And if we unpack the $37 billion,
roughly 25 of the 37 were LPs selling their interests, and the other 8 were GPs looking to either restructure their fund or they like an asset that they want to continue to hold. So if you look at the growth between the LP component going from 25 to 50, it's roughly a double in that time frame. But if you look at the GP leg going from 8 to 50, it's nearly sixfold. So you're seeing the data showing how the GP-led component of the secondary market is nearly half. Our house view at StepStone is, we think that that ratio is roughly going to be the same going forward. Why? Because GPs have found a way, and secondary investors like StepStone have found a way to come together to provide a continuation mechanism in a aligned way to continue to kind of enjoy the gifts that keep on giving in the private markets through these GP-led continuation funds. And I think the LP market will continue to be incredibly robust, and there will always be some percentage of the primary market that turns over in the secondary market.
So you've been a pioneer in the space, particularly with one of the first real estate secondaries funds, the largest venture capital secondaries fund. Have you seen any demand on the infrastructure side, or are there any other places that would be a natural kind of next step for StepStone here?
Sure, no, that's right. It's interesting you led with the real estate team, because we have the original secondaries team in real estate that dates back to the late 1990s. And what's interesting is we are talking about, in just a minute ago, how GP-led transactions in the private equity space are this new thing. Well, in the real estate market, GP-led transactions were the secondary market. It was GPs figuring out a way to recapitalize the capital structures within the real estate properties that they owned. It was less about LPs selling an interest in a fund. And our team, many, many years ago, kind of built the Trojan horse, built the technology to recapitalize GPs. And so that's where we led, and we have a veteran team that is currently in market with that very fund that does that. In venture capital, the acquisition of Greenspring really was such a strategic move for us and such a great boom for our organization and the Greenspring team, which is why we led with a secondary fund as their first offering post-acquisition. And, you know, it's not necessarily a big surprise, but I think we're all very pleased with raising $2.6 billion at a time when valuations are down 50 or 60%. The $3 trillion differential of the $10 trillion in the ground, which is infrastructure, private credit, and real estate, allows us to play in those markets. And I think, as I mentioned, we're likely going to continue to use our managed account structures to invest in infrastructure through secondary deals and through private credit through managed accounts. So we're well equipped to pursue secondary investments across all the asset classes.
Great. So maybe we can move to your capital distribution and dividend approach that you recently announced. So you're going to continue paying your quarterly dividend in addition to a dividend tied to your performance fees. Does this approach change how you think about inorganic M&A opportunities in the future?
Yeah. Well, thanks for asking this question. It's really important. We were very excited to announce last year a change in our capital management approach. We went public in September of 2020, and we basically conformed to the industry. And we looked around and we said, well, we're just going to do what everyone else does. A couple of quarters into being a public company, we were being asked this capital management question, and it started to like dawn on us that, wait a second, if we look at how cash is flowing into our business, it's coming from two sources. It's coming from fee-related earnings. These are the management advisory fees, net of expenses, have our FRE. That is a very stable, steady, very predictable source of cash flow 5, 7, 10 years out. But we also have this performance fee cash flow where we have $1.1 billion, call it $500 million, of net performance fees sitting as an accrual on our balance sheet that is nothing more than a backlog of future revenue. It will convert into revenue over some period of time. It's just a little more episodic. And so how do you deal with an episodic cash flow and a stable cash flow and come up with a capital management approach? Well, we just took a step back and we made some calls. We called sell-side analysts, we called buy-side investors, and we really took the temperature of the market. And we realized we need to match the distribution, the capital distribution approach to our business model and allow our investors to experience what we're experiencing. And so we decided to do a bifurcate the dividend approach. And we're going to pay out most of our FRE in a quarterly dividend. And then we're going to augment that quarterly dividend with a supplemental dividend each year in June. Our fiscal year ends 3/31 of March. And in June, we're going to announce and issue a dividend that is going to be recurring. And it's supplemental. It's not a special. It's not a one-time thing. And it's going to be largely a full payout of our performance fees, subject to board approval. So what we've done is we've just simply matched our capital distribution approach to our business model. And so we weren't, no more square peg, round hole kind of thing. This makes industrial logic. Does not impede our M&A capabilities whatsoever. We have a very capital efficient business, and we have a very flexible capital structure. We have a revolver. We've used this revolver to flex up and down. And we have an incredibly valuable source of equity. And so if you look back at the Greenspring transaction, it was largely financed out of issuing StepStone equity. And we combined that StepStone equity with an earnout. And why that is essential for StepStone to maintain some sort of alignment with whatever acquisition we do going forward. So the combination of cash through a revolver, equity, and some sort of earnout are the tools we'll use to pursue M&A. So the capital management decision that we made on dividends really has no effect whatsoever on our ability to continue to grow the business through M&A.
Great, and you've been pretty successful with M&A, with 8 main acquisitions since your founding in 2007. Can you discuss any, opportunities that you're seeing in the market today or any, particular geographies or asset classes you'd like to get into?
Sure. That's right. We have had a number of M&A transactions through the years. I think what I'd like to do is maybe contextualize our M&A strategy through the lens of what the world was like for StepStone as a private company, pre-IPO, and what the world is like for StepStone as a public company, post-IPO. Is there different? We used M&A as a private company to build the platform. We used M&A to acquire Citi, that gave us a large co-investment team, that gave us distribution, that gave us a track record, and it really enhanced our private equity capabilities. We used M&A to acquire real estate. We used M&A to acquire infrastructure. We used M&A to acquire private credit. And so we've used M&A pre-IPO as a way to build the platform. Okay, now it's built. And we have the geographic footprint that we want. And we have the distribution capabilities we want. Post-IPO, now how do we think about M&A? Well, we think about it through the lens of accelerating something we're currently doing or augmenting something we're currently doing rather than adding or trying to think about something that we want that we don't have and do something different. What we've done is we've delivered a platform to our shareholders that is purpose-built to augment or accelerate something with an M&A strategy if one presents itself. And that's an important distinction. We're not professing, nor are we stating, our strategy is to roll up the industry. Not at all. But we will be opportunistic. And if an M&A opportunity presents itself and there's a good cultural fit, and we can get the structure right, and we get the right alignment, and it augments something we're currently doing or accelerates something we're currently doing, I think we have a fantastic track record at doing M&A and bringing on large senior teams. And the trickiest part of M&A is not to get the deal done. The trickiest part of M&A is integrating and making sure the integration happens seamlessly and the synergies are captured. So our focus is on integration, not getting deals done.
Great. So let's move to fundraising. Starting with commingled funds, can you give some color on which of your larger funds will be back in market both this year and next year?
Sure. Well, we had a great quarter, as all of you know, and that quarter was largely driven by the activation of two flagship funds. And it was a clean quarter. There were no retroactive fees creating noise in the numbers. And so we activated our flagship private equity secondaries fund. We're very excited about the timing of activating that fund. We also activated our global venture capital fund, and we're also very excited about the timing of that, given where valuations are today in DC. It's an entry point that not a lot of investors are looking forward to taking advantage of. So what are we currently in market with? We're in market with our real estate secondaries fund, as I mentioned. Very excited about that. We're also in market with our first commingled fund for infrastructure. So we have our first infrastructure commingled fund focusing on co-investments. We also have a growth equity fund that's currently in market. And we also have direct lending funds that are floating rate, senior direct lending funds, also in market. So we feel good about what's been activated, and we feel good about what we're currently in marketing, and we're excited to have some more closings this quarter and closings throughout the year across all of our commingled funds. And oh, by the way, commingled funds that are also in market, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, in a minute, are our retail products. And so we have S Prime, which is our retail product for the private markets, and we have Spring, which is our retail product for venture capital and growth equity. So that's basically a fundraising list, if you will, of activities in the commingled space.
Great. So I wanted to move to retail now and talk a little bit more about S Prime and Spring.
Sure.
So you've had some great momentum here, you know, raising, I believe it's four times what you were raising last year, at a moment when retail demand has, you know, come to almost a halt here. So as we think about your retail platform growing, what types of products are you seeing client demand for, you know, outside of venture capital?
Sure. Well, zooming out for a minute again, let's, you know, when we think of, when StepStone thinks about retail, we believe we are in the very early days of the retail investor adopting illiquid strategies and illiquid securities. And StepStone is very much a long-term thinking firm. And so a couple of years ago, in 2019, we decided to make a strategic push. And so we brought a very large senior team on board by the name of Conversus. And we put the cart way before the horse on this one. And we thought, well, if we had the right team and we build the right distribution capabilities, we have the capabilities, the manufacturing capabilities, if you will, to create products that are suitable for the retail market with the expertise and knowledge that the team has that we brought on board. And so we always lead with an attitude of listen first and speak second. So listen to what the retail investors are wanting and looking for, and then we'll build that product. What we heard was that retail investors understand they could pick manager X, Y, and Z, but there are idiosyncratic risks with manager X, Y, Z. Is there a product out there that gives investors a more diversified approach? And so what we led with was a product called S Prime, which is a multi-manager product. So think 40, 50, 60 managers. So it's diversified by manager. And let's come up with a product that also is diversified by strategy. So we have secondaries in there, we have co-investments in there, and some primaries in there. So you have this really diversified approach, a one-ticket stop for the private markets. And then we said, and let's make it available to all the asset classes. So it's private equity, it's real estate, it's infrastructure, and credit. You have multi-strategy, multi-manager. When I say multi-strategy, it's multi-asset class, multi-manager, and multi-strategy. See, this really diversified way for an investor to get access to the entire market in a very efficient way. And what do I mean by efficient? It's a 1.4% management fee with no carried interest. And so there isn't any performance fee eating into the net returns. And then we said, let's make this product available to the widest part of the market. Most of the products out there are for qualified investors. We designed this product to apply all the way down to the accredited investor. That's how we led. And to your point and your observation, we've enjoyed a lot of success mm-hmm. by leading with that product. We then acquired Greenspring. Well, Greenspring gave us what we needed to launch our second retail product in venture capital and growth equity. Same kind of thought process. Now, we would not have done that unless we had a critical mass in S-Prime. But what's the critical mass in S-Prime? We're sitting on 140 RIA platforms. We're sitting on dozens of IBDs, and we landed our first wire this summer. So now we're set up for spring to enjoy the success that S-Prime has enjoyed in the development of those channels. And you can imagine, and we're on fire already, and it's public, with our third retail product in infrastructure. And we're very excited about that. And you can imagine, you know, we are in the process of developing at least one or two more products for the retail space, which is going to ultimately look a bit like a core satellite approach, where an investor could have a core holding in S-Prime in a very diversified way across the private markets and pivot an allocation to a part of the market that they want more exposure, whether it's infra, whether it's venture, whether it might be other areas. You could probably guess what they might be.
Great. And so the third fundraising bucket here is going to be your separately managed accounts. So you have a 90% re-up rate and a 30% average rate of increase here, which gives a pretty visible, you know, steady source of growth. I want to dig a little more here. Can you discuss what the average SMA looks like and what the typical duration is?
Sure. SMAs are really how we led and built the business. You know, we led our offering to the market through SMAs. And as a result, as we're sitting here today, we are managing roughly $80 billion. Of the $80 billion of fee-paying AUM, roughly $50 billion is managed accounts. So it is a very significant part of our business. The duration of the managed accounts is no different than the duration of our commingled funds. So it's a 10-year partnership. You have a 3 to 4 year investment period. You have a 5 to 7 year harvest period. And at the end of year 10, there's typically 1 or 2 years of extensions to finish liquidating whatever is remaining in the portfolio. So from a duration standpoint, it's no different. What is interesting, though, is the re-up conversation with managed accounts typically happens toward the end of the investment period. So call it year 3 or 4, we begin the re-up conversations. The re-up rate, as you pointed out, Sam, is 90%. And not in addition to the 90%, they typically re-up with a mandate that's 30% larger than the original mandate. It's almost like it's perpetual capital in that way, because the counterparty is a single LP. It's a single investor. It's not like you're marketing to thousands of LPs. It's a one-on-one relationship. And so it's incredibly sticky, and it's quite perpetual in nature. So from a duration standpoint, that's a very, very long time.
That's great. So now I want to move to your two tech platforms. You have SPY, which works on the front end, aiding investment decisions, and Omni, working on the back end. So I want to start, how do these benefit both StepStone and the clients today?
Technology and how data has evolved in the private markets is incredibly important. Unlike the private markets, where data is available to everyone, in the private markets, data is only available to those who invest in the private markets, so it's quite limited. And StepStone manages enormous amounts of data, as you can manage, across the private markets and all asset classes and all strategies. SPY was an in-house technology that we created on an Excel spreadsheet back in 2008. And the reason it was created was because we were setting up offices around the world. How do our investment teams work together in real time across the investment due diligence process and ultimately decision-making process? And so we created a technology to enable our investment teams to work through the investment decisioning process. It was incredibly successful internally, and it is a large contributor to our successful track record. As time evolved, we started realizing the importance and the impact of this, and the more value we were extracting from the data that we were importing into SPI. And so we decided to build our own data science and engineering team to code up the software and move it from Excel to something that was a bit more versatile. And so call it 2017, 2018, we started realizing this software is enormously powerful for StepStone as its own internal decisioning tool. What if we make it available to some of our clients? And so in a very select way, we started rolling out SPI with our clients to help them work through their own investment decisioning processes. And it's typically with existing clients, whether they have a managed account or whether it's a commingled fund. And we often use it to cross-sell. So if someone is looking for access to one of our products, we may give them access to SPI as a value-added proposition to help give them the incentive to make that final decision to move over to StepStone. So we do use it as a way to develop business. Now, what we will eventually do is figure out a way to monetize it. Now, we don't know what the enterprise value of that might look like, but there is a lot of blue sky, and we're very excited about it. So what happens after an investor makes the decision to invest and now they have that commitment on their balance sheet or their platform? What's it worth? What do the cash flows look like? Omni is purpose-built to give a look-through, transparency, insight into what LPs own and what it's worth in a very user-friendly way. It's very much like if you have a Schwab or a Fidelity account, and you type in your account, it gives you your schedule of investments, it gives you what it's worth, gives you your returns, you can click through, and you can drill down into everything that you need to know. We've created the private market equivalent to what you see in the public markets when it comes to transparency and analytics, when it comes to what you own, what it's worth, what does the total portfolio look like from a diversification standpoint, what the gaps might be, where you might want to lean into or back off of. It then feeds back to SPI into the investment decisioning tool. So there is a virtuous circle between SPI and Omni, pre-commitment and post-commitment. And so we make Omni available not only to our existing clients, there are lots of investors out there who would love access to Omni with the portfolios that they currently own. And now, if it's okay with you, Sam, I want to expand on technology beyond SPI and Omni.
Sure.
And talk about other technologies that we've created. And one of them that's really important is called the Daily Value Engine. And that must be a pretty interesting concept when you're thinking about the private markets. We all have daily values in the public markets. What would the daily value look like of a illiquid security that is marked once a quarter and only audited once a year? What StepStone has done is through all the data that we have coming in through SPI and Omni, we have collected and we've built a new set of software technology tools to give us and our clients a daily mark. That is what is enabling our retail strategy so effectively, because it's helping us give credibility to our investors and shareholders of what the value is on an interim basis between the quarterly marks and the annual audits of the portfolio that they own. And it helps gives us insight into liquidity and how to manage liquidity for the retail products as well. So the DVE has been a really important tool that we've created purpose-built to enable our retail products.
Great. And maybe in the last few minutes, we can open up to questions in the room.
Awesome. Okay, sorry. So I was interested to see how you got in contact with those 140 RIAs that are now your clients. And, you know, is that effort different than the IBD channel and the wirehouse channel? Like, what does your distribution effort look like across those three kind of retail segments?
Sure. Thanks, Craig. As I mentioned, in 2019, we brought on a large team by the name of Conversus, which we rebranded to StepStone Private Wealth back in November of this past year. So we started out with a 20-person team within a couple of years, that had decades of experience in the RIA channels, in the IBDs, and in the wires. So what we did, Craig, was we hired a very large, capable, veteran team 4 years ago to help unlock those channels for us. And they're responsible for all the channels. So our institutional business development team isn't being repurposed, thinking that they know what they're doing in the retail space. No, we went out and hired a very, very large senior team, and that team is now 50 people strong and growing, I think close to 60 or 70 now. And so really it's about having a dedicated team as opposed to repurposing an existing team.
Given your seat, you get to view the market from kind of a bird's eye view. So I was curious, what are the tones in conversation like with LPs today in terms of allocation amounts and asset classes?
Great, thanks. This has been the topic du jour now for almost the better part of 6 months to a year as the Fed has raised interest rates and there's been lots of inflationary pressure and so on and so on. Of course, a re-rating in the public markets. I think I would describe the LP sentiment when it comes to allocations as such. Most LPs and investors in the private markets today have been around through at least one cycle, if not two. And I think they recognize private markets are not something you back off of during periods of repricing and re-rating. Rather, these are the times to lean into. And so what we're seeing is from a strategic asset allocation perspective, allocations to the private markets really aren't changing one way or the other. If there's a denominator effect and a policy target of 20% is now 23%, we're not going to see LPs backing off and dropping, you know, their budget for the year. They're going to invest through it. And so what we're seeing is investors, for the most part, maintaining the same budget year over year, with some slight tweaks around it. What we are seeing is a change in behavior about how they're deploying, and to your question mark, where they're deploying. 2019, 2020, and 2021 were incredible years of fundraising. GPs were coming back to market at light warping speed. And what was happening was LPs were burning through their annual budgets in 6 months. And so come July, they were already done. And so fundraising appeared to have slowed in the second half of the year in 21. Fundraising appeared to slow in the back half of 2022. And that behavior had a lot less to do with what was going on in the macroeconomic backdrop, although that's what the perception seemed to be. What was actually happening was the rate at which GPs were coming back to market was so fast and furious that LPs were burning through their allocations in 6 months. I think that has stopped. That party is what people are seeing is over. And so as we turn the corner into 2023, we see the budgets are very healthy and the allocations are healthy. What we expect are LPs to pace themselves and a little bit slower. And so we see the budget for 2023 being spread out over Q1, Q2, Q3, and Q4, rather than burning through the entire budget in the first 3 months. And they're telling GPs, no, I'll see you next quarter, or I'll see you 2 quarters from now, rather than saying, okay, I'm in. The second part of your question, Mark, was where are they sort of allocating their capital? And as I mentioned earlier, we're seeing an increased demand in secondaries. And so, yeah, StepStone faces the same fundraising behavior that every GP faces when it comes to budgets and allocations. What we're seeing is the demand for what we do in the secondary space is really increasing and under a lot of demand. We're also seeing demand for real assets as a hedge against inflation, and we're seeing demand for floating rate securities in the senior secured direct lending part of the market. And we're seeing GPs take a little more time in the normal private equity buyout space.
So you said a few things on VC earlier I was interested in, but you know, corporate private equity, US buyout, you have denominator effect, it's a crowded backdrop, but in VC, I want to hear what it looked like more in VC, where are VC marks down last year as much as public equity and public debt, so you don't have that denominator effect? Is that one thing? And is the backdrop less crowded from a fundraising perspective? And why are you seeing such good demand now when the returns?
You know, in the VC space, there was no hiding. When the tech stocks started to re-rate and reprice, there was very little the VC market could do but sort of recognize that and take the adjustments that they needed to take. Many of them took the adjustments they needed to take mid-year of 2022, so call it June 30th. And we saw, you know, continuation of re-rating in venture capital throughout the year. As we move into 2023, what we're seeing is LPs recognizing this is this is the time that they've been waiting for. 2018, 2019, 2020, 2021, the valuations and the multiples on revenue without any earnings were off the charts. Here you have an environment where valuations have come in, Craig, and LPs are now saying, ah, this is the moment to enter the venture capital space that I've been waiting for, because valuations have been so difficult to get comfortable with. That's the rationale, because VC has re-rated the way it should have re-rated.
Great. And with that, we're out of time. So thank you, Mike. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Sam.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.